decided to come to Hazleton. He was working at the Ridge Memorial Hospital. And first of all, of course, he came through Hazleton in 1896 by horse and pack horse all the way from Ashcroft. And
who was he with at that time?
He was with Jimmy Tate, anthropologist who wanted to come up through this country and study the native people. And so they came up as far as Hazleton, and they sold their horses in Hazleton, and then they took the steamboat out to Victoria and then back to Spence's Bridge and Merrick from there.
Was your grandfather a packer?
No.
And what did they use for packing? Did they have mules or horses?
No, horses. Yeah.
I guess mules or donkeys weren't too good in this area because of the wet, is that right?
Well, I don't know about that. Catiline used a lot of mules.
Did he?
Yeah. But it just happened that they had horses, and of course horses are a little bit easier to handle than mules.
Yeah. How big was his pack train?
Oh, they just had a couple of pack horses and a saddle horse each. There was three of them. They had three saddle horses, I guess, and two pack horses.
Well, how many miles would they make a day on their trip?
Oh, something like, I would imagine, 20 miles.
I see.
I don't know just how long it took them. It's quite a journey. The steamboats were still running when they got here, so it couldn't have been too late in the summer.
How often did the steamboat run?
Well, they just ran when the water was fairly high. They couldn't run when the water was low because there was too many gravel bars.
How many steamboats did they have? Just the one flying back and forth?
No, they had as many as six, I think, at one time. I'm not sure, though.
Where did they come from?
Well, they came from Port Essington.
I see.
To Hazleton.
Well, then your grandfather came back after that, did he?
Yes, he came back during the 30s and worked at Terrace for some time. And then he went back to the Nicola Valley, of course, and then went at boat. The end of the war, or just before the end of the Second World War, he came back to Hazleton and got a job as a gardener at the hospital. And of course, being as he was up here, well then I decided to come up here looking for a farm, and I got a job working with the Department of Highways to start with. And we went down, a crew of us went down to tear down the buildings down at the airport at Woodcock. That was one of the first jobs I was on.
I see. And that was in 1946?
Yeah, that was in 1946. And then, of course, I had a chance to go through to Fort Babeen with Mr. Alan Benson and Percy Foster and Tony West, the provincial police was here, and that took us 3 days each way. We took a pack horse and three saddle horses. The fish warden at Fort Babeen, he took Mr. Benson and I down to the counting gate, to see the counting gate where they count the fish. And on the way down, we were talking to three natives from Nilkitwa who had just caught a spring salmon. It would be more than 6 foot long. And I don't know what the girth would be, but I would estimate it to be about 130 pounds at most, at the least, I should say.
I can't imagine a fish being that big.
Oh, it was fantastic. And the fish warden, he didn't even ask these fellows to bring it up and weigh it, up to Fort Babine and weigh it.
So there were, that was an ordinary thing then, to find one big like that?
Oh,
it?
No, that was an extraordinary fish then.
That sounds like a real fish story.
Yeah, but it isn't. You could ask Mr. Benson. It was a fantastic fish. I was really surprised to see such a salmon as that, you know.
Whereabouts was that county gate?
About a mile down the river, after the river runs out of Nilkitwa Lake.
Is that near Babine?
Yeah, Nilkitwa Lake is just a... the river actually, but it's quite wide, and then it gradually narrows down just about a mile before you get to the counting gate.
Is that counting gate still there?
They put it in every summer, yeah. They take it out for the winter, you see, and put it back in the summer, and they count all the fish, so they know how many fish come up there.
Mm-hmm.
This salmon must have got up the river before the counting gate was put in the spring, because he couldn't have got through the counting gate.
My goodness.
He was so big.
And that was just after you came up here that you made that trip,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us what Hazleton was like when you first came?
Well, there wasn't the modern houses you see today. It's pretty hard to explain.
Well, the church, the Anglican church was there then.
Oh yes, the present churches in Old Hazleton were all there at that time. And there's 2 Mile and the other towns are the ones that have changed the most, mind you. 2 Mile, where the Loring residents and Johnny Olson's residents and Latai residents there was no houses there at all. It was an open field. And the only houses right around there were Mrs. Brown's house and Mother's house. Barney Moe's cabin, and, Huey McMillan Sr., Scotch Huey McMillan, and Gordy McLennan's cabin. And then there was Mr. Hodder's cabin, or it wasn't Mr. Hodder's cabin at that time, it was Harry Martin's cabin.
Those people are not living now?
No, they're all passed away now.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Mrs. Brown, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And a chap by the name of Denno built Mother's house. He moved it from his son-in-law's place up the creek, you know, way up the creek here. His son-in-law's name was Mike George. And Mike and him hauled his house down from his place where the Scotty
near where Withers are?
Withers, Scotty Withers is living, yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Were there any other houses up near there too then?
Well, there must have been 2 houses there at the time, I guess. I guess Mike George must have had a house of his own. I think these houses were used when the Silver Standard Mill was operating. In the early days of 1914, I think it was.
Was the mill closed down when you came?
Yes, that mill was, yes. Mm-hmm. And the Silver Standard started up afresh two or three years after I came up. And then, of course, they built a new mill right up at the mine. And all their buildings were right up at the mine. And then they operated for over 10 years, I guess. Eventually ran out of ore. Yes, when we first moved to 2 Mile here, Mr. Sinden had quite a few milk cows, and they used to roam all over 2 Mile here, and they kept the brush down and the grass down, and it was just like a park at that time. It was nice to have those cattle around.
Well, to get up there to Withers, like where those people were that, you know, who was it that you got the cabin from? Your mother's cabin. Was it George?
Well, Mike George and...
Mike George.
And his father-in-law, Denno, I don't know Denno's first name, but Denno moved this cabin down to 2 Mile here. You see, Denno had some lots. Lots that mother bought down here, and they moved that house down there and reconstructed it, you see.
Well, what was it, just a cow trail up through there?
Oh, no, that was the road to the Silver Cup Mine. Well, it was much more than a cow trail, but it was a good wagon road, you might say, you know. Pretty near the same as it is now. Mm-hmm. Not much different.
Was there a cafe in 2 Mile when you came?
Well, I wouldn't. There was no cafe here since I've come here, other than what Mr. Sinden used to have down
at the table.
He converted his barn into a pool hall and cafe. There used to be roadhouses, what you might call roadhouses in the early days, but that was before my time.
Whereabouts were they then?
Well, I don't know for sure. People claim there was one on Mother's property there. I don't know.
I see. And then were there many people living up around the bend here near Myers's?
Where Myers's place is. There was a house there that Mr. York built, and as far as I know, Mr. York built it, and then he sold it to Dave Pratt, and then eventually the house burned down, and then the only other houses up in this end were Mrs. Webster's house, and Jack Robinson's house, and Mr. Arthur Hindle's little cabin, and George Clark's cabin, and then a man by the name of Danley built the house that Alvin Forsyth is living in now. It must have been, I would say, about 1950 when it was built.
I see. So it's not that old, really, is it?
No. And then later on, those other houses were built. Bill Ludwig built his house about that time, too. And Virgil Jensen. And Len Valancourt built house right behind Pat Slezinski's there, that little house. I don't know just when Fargy built his house, just about that same time. So most of the houses are built, not too long ago.
So how many families would be here when you came here?
Well, Well, there wouldn't be half as many as there are now. I don't know just how many there would be.
And what were they doing, most of them? What were they working at?
Well, most of the fellows were working at Silver Standard that built new houses here.
Was the logging going when you first
came? Oh, yes, yes. There was quite a bit of logging up here. There was three mills up this, what they call the 9 Mile Road here. And Bob Allen had a mill up there, and Bob Willen had a mill up there, and Gordon Leary had a mill past the Silver Standard. I think there's another mill up the 9 Mile Road, too.
That seems a lot of mills, and they must have been fairly close together then.
Oh, yes, there was a lot of mills. There was in the neighborhood of 50 mills in the Hazleton area at that time.
Wow.
Small mills.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was better for the country than the one big mill is today. Although some people didn't get their pay sometimes, but just the same, there was a continuous supply of timber, where now there isn't, you know. They log it off, clean cut, well then it's going to be another 70 to 80 years before there's any more timber to be cut. And what they get then will be nothing but limbs, it won't be good saw timber, it'll only be fit for pulp. So the days of the saw timber are gone. Saw timber is only created through trees growing in the shade of other larger trees. When they grow in the shade, they go straight up. They don't limb out. Where if they're grown like they are today, planted in the cutoff areas, well, they're all the same age,
mm-hmm.
and the sun gets at them equally, so therefore they're nothing but a mass of limbs.
Mm-hmm. And was there still a lot of trapping going on here?
Oh, yes. Yes, there was a lot of trapping when I came here. And fur was a very good price.
What were the furs, most of them? Do you remember?
Pardon?
What furs were they collecting?
Oh, pretty near everything. Marten was worth about $60 at that time. And I didn't... Oh, beavers were a good price, too. I don't know just what they were. But, fur was very good, providing you brought your fur in at the right time of the year. The price went down at Christmas time, when the trappers came in. But if they'd got in the 1st of December with a bunch of furs, they'd got a real good price for them. And then if the price went up after Christmas again to encourage the trappers to go back out again, you see. And if they'd have just stayed in a little longer and not got rid of their furs just as soon as they came in, if they'd have stayed in a month and waited till the end of that month before they sold their furs, they'd have done real well. But, of course, they were anxious to get their money as soon as they got in and didn't think that the price would be going up again. So then in the spring when they came in again, well, then the price was down again.
So that part hasn't changed a bit, has it?
It's just No, I don't think so. I think they do the same trick all the time.
Yeah. Were there a lot of berries at that time? Did you go berry picking?
Yes. It doesn't change an awful lot. You always have your good years and your bad years, you know.
But I would imagine when there were so many sawmills that maybe the berry picking might even be better.
No, I don't think so. I think the berry picking actually now is better. But it's not a very important thing, to tell you the truth. I'd rather see the timber than
yes.
and just improved berry picking, because there's always enough berries anyhow, so it doesn't make much difference. But these huge clearings that they've made now are conducive to good berry picking. The raspberries grow like mad on these burns and so on, so it means an awful lot of raspberries. In fact, well, right now it would take a tremendous amount of people out picking berries to keep up with the amount of berries that we have now.
So at least everybody can get enough for themselves.
Oh yes, there's no excuse for anybody not getting enough raspberries anyhow.
What about the other berries, huckleberries and
well, you have to go fairly high for huckleberries. I've seen the odd real good year for huckleberries, but not very many. But the trouble is with huckleberries, they're always good in different places, different years, and you have to be a scout in order to scout out the berry patches and find out where they are good, you know.
So everybody gets pretty good at scouting, so.
Well, some of them do anyhow. Mm-hmm.
And were there a lot of bears here when you came?
Oh, well, yes. Oh, yes. They're just like the berries. Some years there's lots, some years there's very few. It depends on how much feed there is farther away, you know, on the mountains.
Would you see grizzlies when you came?
No, I never saw any grizzlies for quite a long time. The only grizzlies I've seen were on Nine Mile Mountain one year when the feed was very, very scarce elsewhere. And I saw four grizzlies that summer up on Nine Mile. They were the most beautiful animals I've ever seen. The whole four of them had black backs and tan heads and tan legs. Just like a German Shepherd dog, just like some of these Alsatians, you know. Mm-hmm. Very pretty. And they were so hungry and so deprived of food that summer that they dug up all the lupins on Nine Mile Mountain.
Oh.
You couldn't find a live lupin after they got through.
Does the lupin have a bulb? Is that what they were?
A root. It's got a root. Oh, something like a dandelion, you know. They don't normally eat very many lupin roots, but this year there was nothing else for them to eat.
Well.
And they just cleaned up all the lupin. Mm-hmm. It's a wonder there's a lupin on Nine Mile Mountain now.
Were there any stories or any incidents that you can remember that people talk about, or that you can remember from your own experience?
Probably is. Would you like to hear a little of Catline's history?
Sure.
Well, Catline, he came from Catalonia, northern Spain, in the Pyrenees, and he came by boat to some place in Louisiana or somewhere on the Gulf of Mexico there, and he walked or rode on a mule or something. He crossed over and got into California, and then he trekked north from there right up to British Columbia. And when he got to Yale, he met up with an old friend of his from Catalonia too, and this chap had already been in business. I don't know what kind of business he was in, but he had a fair amount of money, and he was able to stake Catline to enough money, loan Catline enough money to buy a pack train. I don't know how many mules Catline had in his first pack train, but it was a fair amount. So Catline went into the packing business and started packing in the Madison Creek gold. Well, first of all, it was the Caribou Gold Rush. And so he packed for years from Ashcroft to Barkerville. And then when the Caribou Gold Rush petered out, he packed for the Manson Creek Gold Rush. And then, of course, when that petered out, there was the Klondike, and he packed for the Klondike from Hazelton to Dawson City. Well, while Catline was packing to Barkerville, there was sort of an amusing incident happened. He had loaded up these two pack trains in Ashcroft, and then he'd taken his 50 mules ahead. And he had a native fellow that was in charge of the second pack train. And so Catline helped unload it, Barkerville, and he found one packet was missing. So he asked the packer where this packet was. Well, the native packer said, he said, that packet, it went bad, he says. And he says, I threw it in Soda Creek. I was afraid it was going to spoil all the rest of the stuff. Well, Catline says, do you know what that was? He says, that was Limburger cheese, special order, right from Germany, for this wealthy fella in Barkerville. Well, when Catline got up on the packing to, well, then he packed into the Klondike and to Dawson City for years, and then eventually the Telegraph, he got the contract for packing for the Telegraph line. And then he took people to Dawson that, you know, just people that were traveling, you know. And he had some school teachers that were going into Dawson. And well, this was his second pack train that these school teachers were with. And Catline had already got to Dawson with his pack train. And for some reason or other, these mules took a notion that they weren't going to swim the Yukon River at Dawson. And those fellas couldn't get those mules into the water for love nor money, you know. So Catline heard him over there, and he got in a boat and went over. And then he started swearing at these mules in Spanish. He just ranted and raved at those mules for about 15 to 20 minutes. And then he led one of the mules up to the water, and the mule walked right in, and they all walked into the water and swam the river.
I guess they understood Spanish.
Well, when they disbanded the Telegraph line, Catline, moved up to Telegraph Creek, and he did the odd bit of packing. He was getting pretty old then. He did the odd bit of packing into different places in the Omanika, you know.
What year was that?
I would say some around 36. I think it was 36 he moved out to George Burns' farm to retire. But this is the story I was just going to tell, is that when he decided to move away from Telegraph Creek, well, one day Willie Campbell, his one of his packers, saw big smoke up at Catline's farm. And he didn't know Catline was moving or anything, and so he thought, well, something's happened up there. So he got a bunch of the boys and they rushed up there. And here was Catline, he had all the mules all packed up, and he was down at one end of the field, far end of the field, and the house and the barn were going up in flames. And Willie said, Catline, he says, what are you doing? What are you doing? Oh, Catline, he had a great big grin on his face. He says, I'm moving out. And he had his pack train all ready to go, and he was cleaning up before he went. So then he moved out and stayed with George Burns. George Burns had a cabin for him up there in the end of his days up at the Burns farm. That's where Marty Allen lives now.
I see. That's really interesting. And do you remember hearing anything about those men? There was Norman Lee for one that went through this area with cattle for Dawson.
Oh, yes. I read about Norman Lee and all the problems he had and so on. The first trouble he met was at Rose Lake. There's a big flat there they called Poison Flats, and a lot of his cattle got larkspur poisoning there, and he lost quite a few. And then, of course, he didn't meet up with so much serious trouble, I guess, only lack of feed. He had no feed for his animals, and they must have been just nothing but skin and bone when they got to Lake Bennett.
Terrible trip, really, for the poor man. He was trying to make some money so he could take a trip back to England. I think that was the idea of it.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I read in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying something you heard about a medicine man when you came up here. Could you tell us about him?
Oh, yes. He was quite a colorful character. His name was Luke Fowler. And he used to travel the whole of this country up as far as Telegraph Creek, east to Tacla Lake and that country up there, and Manson Creek. And he had a claim or two up there, up at Manson Creek, and he used to do a little placer mining and got a little bit of gold and did a little trapping up there and so on. Well, once when Luke was going north, he stopped in to visit George Burns up the Kispiocks. And George had a lot of faith in Luke's ability to forecast the weather. So George asked Luke, he said, Luke, if you'll tell me what the weather's going to be like for the next 2 weeks, I'll give you $10. Well, Luke said, all right. And he laid down on the grass and studied this guy for 2 hours. And, well, it got to be 12 o'clock and ready for dinner, and Mrs. Burns had dinner already. And so George says, well, Luke, he says, what's the weather going to be like? Well, Luke says, it's going to be nice, sunny weather for 2 weeks straight. So George was tickled pink, and he gave him the $10 and said, well, come on in and have dinner. So they went in and they had their dinner, and then after dinner was over, well, Luke went merrily on his way north to Telegraph Creek and all points in between, and George, he hooked up the horses and he went to town cutting hay, and he cut all that day and all the next day and the next day after that till he had over 100 acres of hay knocked down. And then he got it all raked up, and when he got it raked up, it started to rain, and it didn't stop raining the rest of the summer. So poor George, he didn't have any hay when it come winter time. But he took his horses all up to a big river flat on the Skeena, just south of Caldo. And luckily there was no snow that winter or at all up there, and the grass was 6 feet high. So the horses did real well, wintered real well, and came out in good shape in the spring. So George was very fortunate.
He really was, wasn't he? That could have been a tragedy.
Well, it sure could have been. And I guess it was a tragedy for poor old Luke, too, because he was a little bit scared to go back to see George after that. And those nice dinners he used to have, well, there it was something to be missed.
Did you make any other trips with horses that you could tell us about?
Oh, yes. Long before there was any... much of a road past Marty Allen's place, when Norman Hagen was about, I'd say, 16 years old, we decided we all wanted to see the Upper Kispionics. None of us had, and so I made a deal with the Hagen boys. They'd supply the horses, I'd supply the grub, you see, and so that was fine with them. So when I had a chance, we got a bunch of grub together and went up to Hagen's, and we took horses, and we went from their place up the valley. We camped the first night at where the A-frame is. There used to be a barn where that A-frame house is, or just a little the other side, right along the road there somewhere. And we camped overnight where that barn was. And, well, it rained during the night, and my boots got soaking wet. And so in the morning, I put my boots against, a little too close to the fire, with the back of the boot towards the fire, and went and burnt my boots. And they just buckled right in. The best pair of boots I ever had, a pair of heads.
What time of year was this?
Oh, this was midsummer. I don't know, it wasn't midsummer, it was in June. It was really a little bit too early to make a trip like that. About the end of June. And so anyhow, luckily, Henry had a spare pair of boots, so he loaned them to me, because I couldn't wear my own after that. Well, anyhow, we went on from there. Now, I can't remember just where we spent the next night, where we camped for that night, but we went up as far as Sweet Inn River, where the Sweet Inn runs into the Kispionics. And that's as far as we could go because the river was so high. Well, so then we came back, and we camped at Corral Creek. Well, we still had lots of daylight left, and so we went away up Corral Creek a ways to see what the country was like back there. And here we saw a grizzly track. It was about 18 inches long. It was a sure big grizzly. And so I had a 30-30 and Henry had a 30-30. Well, anyhow, while we were back there, we all had a drink out of the creek, and Henry took his cigarettes out of his pocket so they wouldn't fall in the creek while he was having a drink. And then he forgot them, left them there. So we got back to where the horses were. Henry went to have a smoke, and he realized he'd forgotten his cigarettes, so the boys had to go back. So they didn't want to go back up where that grizzly was without they had two 30-30s, because a 30-30 is not a very good rifle to tackle a grizzly with, you know, and it's nice to have two if a grizzly happened to attack on you. And so they went back, but that left us, Dallas and I, without a rifle of any kind, so we were awful mighty glad the grizzly stayed away from us and the horses. Well, anyhow, the boys got back, and so we had our supper and spent the night and got going the next day, and we got back to Tommy Jack's cabin that day and camped there, I think it was. Or did we? Let's see now. Yeah, I think we spent the night about there, somewhere around Tommy Jack's cabin. And then the next day we got out. We got all the way back to Hagen's, I think, the next day after that. But I guess there wasn't anything actually spectacular about that trip.
The mosquitoes and the black flies.
Yeah, they had a very good time, the mosquitoes and black flies.
Fed them a little, anyway.
Yeah. Fargy built his house just about that same time. So where Myers' place is, they ran out of ore. Yes, when we first moved to 2 Mile here,
those people are not living now.
No, they're all passed away now.
Mm-hmm.